Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
It has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big stop!
Oh,
brother!
Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me as usual is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yes, very excited.
We are continuing our WrestleMania series. This time we are going to talk about the Boston Celtics playoff battles against Oscar Robertson and the Cincinnati Royals. They've faced off three times in 4 years in 63, 64, and 66. The Celtics won each time, but a couple of those series were extremely close. And, of course, one of the greats of the 1960s, Oscar Robertson, best known for having a triple-double for a season, although his Curtis Harris of Probe's History points out he actually averaged a triple-double over the course of five seasons, 30.3 points, 10.6 assists, 10.4 rebounds per game, mm-hmm. even with, of course, as we know, the increased pace of those times. Pretty good.
No, that's that'll work, especially, yeah, I mean, there are some, obviously, the issues with the pace and whatnot, but still, it's the other people played in the same league at the same time, and he did that, and others
yes.
didn't. So that's what I always, when people do bring that up, it's like, well, I mean, he did it, and nobody yeah, felt like everybody else also had the opportunity to do that, but he did it because he was great, so, and yes. We'll get into it in a little bit, too, in terms of, like, the stats he had when he retired are just, they're just mind-blowing of how good he was.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and of course, you know, the Oscar's been in the news lately, or a few months ago, for saying a little bit of disparaging things about Steph Curry, or the idea that, you know, Steph wouldn't have been, that it's not really that big of a deal what he's doing, and, you know, he would have done it if they were just playing defense and stuff. And I think we can agree that he's wrong about that. I also, you know, Oscar was not always treated the best by the media of the time. He, you know, maybe doesn't always get his due beyond the triple double stuff. Just so I think some of his grumpiness is understandable. I don't agree with the specific things that he's saying, but I'm willing to begrudge him a little. I'm willing to kind of let a little of that slide just because mm-hmm. Once he was just tremendously awesome during his career.
Absolutely.
Both on the court and in his advocacy for players' rights, eventually allowing free agency and things. So I think that Oscar has done far more good than bad in terms of his basketball and social life.
It's going to come to a point where everybody that we do a podcast with will say they're in the news recently for complaining about the modern game. Like, it's just going to become a thing. We're like, oh yeah, like Jack Twyman, just recently somebody, his son got really mad and said, oh, my dad, it's never an extreme of like.
Yeah,
just you can't get away from it.
I feel like almost I just feel like it's almost like whenever they have those interviews with the old players, it's almost like a it's like baiting them a little bit. It's like setting them
The questions are like, well, what do you think? Like, if they have an answer that's not like that, then it probably doesn't come out. But when they're like, I don't think Steph Curry, if there was hand checking, Steph Curry wouldn't score. And it's like, oh, see, like, look, Gary Payton doesn't think Steph Curry is any good, or like, it's just, and they're always framed really terrible too, like.
Yeah, so sometimes the little headline you'll get, it's just a piece of what they said.
Yeah, right. Like the recent Gary Payton thing is like, Gary Payton doesn't think he should be like unanimous or something like that. And people are like, oh, he thinks he sucks. And it's like, well, I don't think he said that. Like,
yeah, right. Sad. Yeah, he said that other people should have been unanimous first.
Right.
That kind of thing. But either way, so. But beyond that,
we'll do a whole episode on that. We'll break down this season in review of old crudgy players being mad about Steph Curry. So
all right, well, that'll be
coming up soon. Look for it. Never, but it's fine.
All right. Anyway, so he was the first to average double-digit assists in the season. Destroyed basically every assist record. He also rebounded like a big man and scored incredibly efficiently. The only guard in the NBA to lead in points per game in a season between 50 and 67. And also Curtis listed where he ranks among all guards in the NBA when he retired in 1974. Yeah, both overall and among guards.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. We alluded to a little bit earlier. It's like when he retired, I mean, that guy was on top of the world statistically in a lot of ways for guards. You know, player efficiency rating, fifth overall, first among guards. True shooting percentage, second overall, first among guards. Points per game, second overall, second or seventh overall, second among guards. Assists per game, first overall, first among guards. Of course, rebounds per game, 72nd overall and third among guards. The 72nd overall is definitely, especially for that era, which is so dependent on big men, to have him be 72nd is crazy. Win share, second overall, first among guards. Total points, second overall, first among guards. Total assists, first overall, by way huge margin. First among guards, and then total rebounds, 19th overall, first among guards. So in review, he was first amongst guards in PR, true shooting, assists per game, win shares, total points, total assists, and total rebounds. So yeah, basically the best guard ever when he retired.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that conversation still for today, in that top five or six, best guards ever, I would say. So also was the 1964 MVP, the only player other than Bill Russell or Wilt Chamberlain to win that award between 1960 and 68. He was 9 times All-NBA first team, 2 times on the second team, and finished top in win shares per 48 for 8 straight seasons. Top 4 for that in 8 straight seasons. The Royals themselves, kind of plagued by mismanagement and ownership troubles. They had a lot of instability in their ownership, despite, they had pretty good talent, especially in Oscar's early years. Along with Oscar, they also had Jack Twyman. They would later have Jerry Lucas. They had Bob Boozer for a while. So some solid players, but never really could get. And also they were battling the Celtics all that time and the Warriors and the Sixers as well during some of those times, Wilt's team. So yeah, it was obviously a tough road to get through. They were pretty good from 62 to 66, especially in the 64 season. After that, they started to fall off. And then Oscar went to the Bucks and did pretty well there. Oscar and Russell, their relationship, they were regarded as friends. Not a whole lot of details that I could find. One that was notable is that from Oscar's book, The Big O, Russell and the other Celtics would come to his house and his wife, Yvonne, would cook a big dinner for them. So that goes along with a lot of the social aspects that we've talked about players during this time, yeah. Particularly, black players. Who, of course, were, dealt with segregation, racism, and all that stuff, and, would be bond together because they, in many situations, didn't really have anyone else to bond with, unfortunately. Right. So,
and another one of the weird, things where people are like, oh, back in the day, the players weren't friends with one another. It's like, yes,
right,
they were.
Yes, exactly.
They absolutely
yes.
were. Like,
right, yes.
They were very good friends with one another. They just competed on the court, like they always do.
Right, yeah. there were certain people who were like, don't socialize with other people outside of it. But yeah, that's for the most part, I think the idea that didn't happen widely is
right. And particularly like you mentioned with the African-American players had, because it was just like, well, geez, especially we're talking about this time. It's not exactly an easy way for them to, either. I mean, they needed this sort of outlet. To hang out with their fellow players and do all that sort of stuff, because I'm sure they were. I mean, of course, we know that they were still going through tons of issues outside of the court because of their color. So it was nice to sort of have a friend and a confidant, that you could go to and hang out with and do all that sort of stuff. So.
Yeah. And mentor, sure. That kind of thing. Yeah. Just somebody who could help you just deal with all the stuff they had to deal with as an NBA player. And Oscar was the only person that Bill Russell told that he was retiring beforehand, late in the 69 season, before he didn't even announce his retirement until kind of later into the summer, did that sort of publicly. I think we're going to talk about that a little bit in one of our later shows. But anyway, yeah, Oscar was the only person who knew for sure ahead of time that Russell was going to retire. They talked about it after one of the last games they played together. And in 1964, Russell and Robertson were among a United States All-Star team that toured Yugoslavia, Croatia, Poland, Romania, and Egypt. It was coached by Auerbach, and included were Bob Cousy, who was right after he had retired, Tom Gola, Tom Heinsohn, Casey Jones, Jerry Lucas, and Bob Pettit. It was rare, especially this time, for a U.S. team to tour behind the Iron Curtain. And there's a interesting thing from there is that Oscar made a joke to Red about how the Celtics wouldn't be anything without Russell, which he said in front of Cousy. And then Oscar in his book later implied that was perhaps a reason why Cousy and him didn't particularly get along when Cousy would coach the Royals later on in the 60s. Perhaps that Cousy had been offended by that remark.
I mean, he's not wrong.
You know.
But okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
well,
Cousy knows that too, right?
We don't know if Oscar, if that's really what Cousy thought.
Yeah, right.
But it, you know, it was sort of interesting to see that observation, and that must have been I've seen a little bit written about that tour, but that's sort of an interesting kind of group of guys, mostly you know Celtics and old you know Warriors. Kind of a random assortment of NBA guys, mostly Celtics, obviously. So, but yeah, their first battle was in 1963. It was a 7-game series, the Celtics winning 4-3. This was the Royals' first year in the Eastern Division. The Warriors had moved to San Francisco, so they were out west, and so Cincinnati with Oscar moved to the east. The Celtics were 58-22. The Royals were 42-38, and so how did they get there?
The playoff path for the Royals, they upset the 48-win Syracuse Nationals in the first round. They won 3-2 that series. Game 5 saw Cincinnati win 131-127. So, of course, as we mentioned, of course, the increased pace of this league. So you get high scores like that, which, of course, you know. Oscar, he scored 32 in this one. And this was the first time that the Cincinnati Royals who advanced to the division final since 1952. And then a little bit of background. Following the season of the Nationals, they relocated to Philadelphia, and they became the 76ers, and they were filling the void left by the Warriors, who moved to the Bay Area, which is, of course, the reason why the Cincinnati Royals were in the Eastern Division. So a lot of fun little stuff there. The Celtics path, it wasn't very interesting. They got a bye in the first round because they were good. So they won 58, so they didn't have to play in the first round.
And the Royals had originated in Rochester, New York. So from the from the beginning of the mid 40s through the I think 57-58 was when they moved to Cincinnati. So and they had really they were kind of a powerhouse in the late 40s and early 50s, but obviously, as you mentioned, they had a lot of futility up until up until this season.
Key Celtics in the series, Bill Russell, of course, with the series with the Royals and the Celtics. Bill Russell, he was the NBA MVP that year. In the series, he averaged 16.8 points per game and 23.6 rebounds per game. Sam Jones, 19.7 points per game for himself. And then Tommy Heinsohn, 18.9 points per game and 7.5 rebounds per game. So kind of a common, those are your key Celtics. I mean, you got a few guys here and there, but yeah, those are the key cogs there. As far as Cincinnati, Oscar Robertson, of course, he was All-NBA first team this year. Averaged 28.3 points per game in the series, 10.4 rebounds per game, and 9.5 assists per game. And then Jack Twyman, he averaged 19.8 points per game in the regular season, then he exploded for 25.2 in the first round of playoffs. But then against the Celtics, so the first round against the Nationals. Then again with the Celtics, he kind of fell back to reality. And he only averaged 17.6 per game in that series. So it had a big first round, but yeah, couldn't follow it up, unfortunately, against the Celtics.
Yeah, and other guys who were kind of part of the Royals during that time were Wayne Embry, who was a really strong rebounder, big man. He would later be part of the Celtics at the end of his career at the last couple years of the Celtics. He would win rings there, and then he would later be a really groundbreaking African American GM for the Bucks and later the Cavs, and they also had Bob Boozer, who was a really good rebounding forward, who would later play for the Lakers, and Tom Hawkins, who also would had come from the Lakers and then later play for the Lakers again. Those are kind of the main guys, and Bucky Buckhorn would be the other standout guy. I don't know much about Bucky Buckhorn.
So he's got a great name. That's all.
Yeah, Bucky or Bucky Buckhorn. Excuse me.
Still good. That's still fine.
Yeah,
so as far as the series, key games, game one, Cincinnati made a statement. They got a game one win, 135-132. Oscar exploded. He had a game high 43. Wayne Embry, who you mentioned, and Jack Twyman, they added 22 and 20, respectively. there. Things got a little bit weird. The Royals, they were forced to play games 4 and 6 in a smaller arena because the circus was in town. And apparently nobody had told management that the circus was going to be there. So that was...
Yeah, that was during kind of like the weird ownership type thing. Yeah. And from the Big O...
Whoops, sorry.
Yeah. And basically, he described it as the team walked onto the Cincinnati Gardens for practice, and then suddenly they saw that the floor was covered with sawdust and hay, and we had to step over giant piles of elephant shit. So
not great.
Not so fun.
Not great.
Just another kind of, I think sort of shows the kind of the Bush League of the NBA at the time. And also in particular, that great in Cincinnati. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially at the Big O. I remember reading that a few years ago, and it's just like there's just full chapters devoted to how terrible this organization was ran. And it's just unbelievable. Game 5. Boston takes a 3-2 lead. They win by 5 thanks to 34 from Heinsohn and 24 from Russell. Robertson, of course, has a great game. He has a game-high 36 there. And then game 6, Cincinnati staves off elimination with a 10-point win, 109-99. And the score played more to kind of Cincinnati's pace and style because, of course, knowing, listen to this podcast, you probably are aware of this at this point, but the Celtics like to run, and they like to score a lot, and they like to, play fast pace. Cincinnati like to slow it down a little bit, and this was their game. 109-99 is much more of their pace as opposed to the other ones. Which you'll see in the final game in the series, Boston dominated. They scored 142 to win the championship, 142-131. Oscar, he had 43. The next best total was 19 by Adrian Smith, who was a lesser-used player at that time. Yeah. On the Celtics side, Sam Jones, he exploded for 47 in this game. And then, Robertson, he said later, I believe... Was this from the Big O, or was this just from a newspaper?
Yes, it was from the Big O.
Okay, that's what I thought. It was almost as if they couldn't go forward and play aggressively against the green and white Celtics uniforms. So it just, seeing those uniforms, they were done,
Right.
And especially in that big of a game, in that series, a series clinching game, it's like, it's the Celtics, man. Like, it's going to be hard.
Yeah. One thing that Oscar was not afraid to do was kind of throw his teammates a little bit under the bus and about how, and he was also kind of like a hard guy to play with in general. I mean, he's obviously incredibly talented and incredibly gifted, but he was really hard and grating on his teammates. A lot of the teammates reported that. It sort of reminds me of Chris Paul, where he's just sort of such a demanding guy who just expects perfection out of everybody and expects everyone to kind of play to his level. And obviously, very few people have the level of talent that he has. And it was just kind of a frustrating thing for him to kind of go. And it would, lead to people respected him, but people just didn't always enjoy playing with him. So next we have the 1964 Eastern Division Finals. The Celtics won this one 4-1. The Royals were 55-25, so really good regular season. That was under their first year coach, Jack McMahon, who had come from the Chicago Zephyrs. He also was a player in the first Hawks Celtics series where the Celtics won the championship 57. And Boston was 59-21. For the playoff path, the Royals had taken to 5 games by the 34-win 76ers, who of course had been the Nationals, who they'd upset the previous year. This was pre-Wilt would not come until 65. So, a lesser team, obviously sort of a team in transition, and Boston got a bye in the first round. So, who were the standouts for the Celtics and the Royals this year?
Yeah, the Celtics, they were kind of your prototypical Celtics team in a lot of ways. Bill Russell, 15 points per game, 24.7 rebounds per game. Sam Jones, 19.5 points per game. And then John Havlicek, 19.9 points per game. As I mentioned, they were kind of your prototypical Celtics team. They were first in SRS, first in pace, first in defensive rating, and ninth in offensive rating. So pretty much, exactly what you would expect a Celtics team of this time to be. So as far as the Royals, they had the NBA's best offense that year, 98.9 points per 100 possessions. They led the league in points per game as well, at 114.7. They're way, way more high-powered than they were the previous year, and a lot of that is because of Jerry Lucas, the performance of him. Oscar Robertson, he was also, not to be outdone, he was the NBA's MVP that year. 31 points per game, 9.9 rebounds per game, and a league-leading 11 assists per game. I thought this was kind of crazy, too. 16.2 offensive win shares in one single season, which is not bad if you follow that stat at all. That is pretty good.
Yeah.
Jerry Lucas, of course, I mentioned rookie season, very good as well. 17.7 points per game, 17.4 rebounds per game. And then Wayne Embry, 17.3 points per game and 11.6 rebounds per game. So those are your key to an extent. You mentioned his name a little bit earlier, but the Royals, they had traded Bob Boozer away for, as you put it, a mediocre white player, Larry Silverman. Both Robertson and Russell decreed this is yet another example of quotas. Russell later said the Royals could have beaten us, but in my opinion, they virtually gave Bob Boozer away to get down to their black quota, and they gave us a championship in the bargain. So, yep. not to be outdone. I mean, it's a very odd trade because Bob Boozer was good and Larry Silverman was not. So it's like, what was the plan there?
They're not a great one. So, this was kind of like right at, this might have been the best Celtics team. They were really stacked here. This is sort of right at the end for Ramsey and Luskadoff and Clyde Livellet, who had come around, and Havlicek was 23. Russell was 29. Sam Jones was 30. So those guys are getting up there, but they're still, you know, fairly young. Satch Sanders is 25. So it's kind of right at the time where they're kind of getting that, you know, injection of youth, but their main players are still, you know, 29 or 30. They're you know, still close enough to their prime where, you know, everyone's kind of the timing was kind of right for them to sort of be like right at, you know, right at their peak.
Sure.
And this would be, I believe, they had one more year after this where they would win the division. And then after that, they did not win the division again. Mm-hmm. So in game one, Boston pretty much dominated, 103-87. Oscar only had 20. Lucas only had 11. Sam Jones and Heinsohn both had 20 plus. Russell shut down Lucas in particular, holding him to single digit rebounds and 4 field goals in the first game in Boston. Next game four, since he was down 3-0, but they finally do win thanks to big games from Robertson and Twyman, who had 33 and 31 points. Russell had only 9 points, 7 of which came from the free throw line. And the final game, Lucas was a complete non-factor with 6 points. Oscar had a game-high 24, but the Celtics just had, you know, they were really well-rounded, had too much. Jones at 23, Russell at 20, Heinsohn at 19, and Havlicek had 13, which, of course, you know, was kind of a usual thing for the Celtics. They just were a team that was hard to deal with, so... one thing I want to bring up is that Twyman's definitely a guy who's been a little bit forgotten, but you know, he was a 6-time All-Star. I mean, he was a really good running mate for Oscar. I believe that he and Oscar are one of the very few tandems to both average 30 points in a season, which, you know, is obviously pretty incredible. So if I'm not mistaken, they both are, or they may have been they were at least both like among the highest scoring tandems of all time. Cause actually I think the year that he scored 30, Oscar was not quite on the team yet, mm-hmm. but it still was a, he was kind of a supporting guy. And he's also very well known for, being after Maurice Stokes had a, was injured during a game and then later flew and then developed a, went into a coma and developed a paralysis and unable to speak. And then he basically took care of Maurice Stokes for the next, you know, decade of his life until he died in 1970. And even though they weren't particularly close as teammates, he kind of took that responsibility. And there have been a lot of great things written about that if people aren't familiar with that story. But he just seems like definitely a guy who doesn't get much, isn't really that, you know, talked about that much, but he's definitely a guy who is has a lot of interesting aspects of him. He's also a broadcaster in the for a while in the 70s as well. So mm-hmm. Definitely contributed to the NBA in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great story if you haven't. I mean, I feel like most people have probably know of it. But yeah, just if you don't, it's incredible. It's a great story.
I think there's a book on it, which I haven't read yet, but that's on my list. So he's definitely an interesting guy. It's definitely discussed in Oscar's book, so as well as others. So so now we are at 1966, where the Celtics win 3-2 in the East first round, the semis. Boston is 54-26. Cincinnati is 43-35. Now Boston, this was again the first year they did not win the division since the Russell dynasty began. Boston defeated the Royals here. Then they beat Philly easily and went 7 games with the Lakers, eventually winning the championship. This was Red Auerbach's final season. And Cincinnati had, they had won the opening round by, They had won the opening round. Oh, I'm sorry. This was the opening round. They lost to Boston in this opening round. So I'm always used to it being the second round because Boston always goes further than that. But yes. So who were the key players on each side for the series?
So the Celtics still seem like a broken record, but I got Sam Jones at he definitely emerged this year, 23.5 points per game. So he emerged as definitely one of their top scorers, or if not the top scorer on the team. John Havlicek, 18.8 points per game, 6.0 rebounds per game for him. Bill Russell, you're starting to see a little bit of the slide from him. Relatively so, 12.9 points per game, 22.8 rebounds per game. So that's unfortunately a slide for Bill Russell, which is not bad. And then Larry Siegfried, who emerging youngster, even though he's 26 years old, but hey, that's fine. But he doubled his point per game and minute per game output. So he was a guy who I started leaning on a little bit more heavily. Key Royals, I mean, who else? It's Oscar Robertson. He led the league in assists per game, 31.3 points per game, 11.1 assists per game, and 7.7 rebounds per game. Jerry Lucas emerged a little bit more, continuing to sort of his rise. Now at age 25 now, 21.5 points per game and 21.1 rebounds per game. Interestingly enough, you look at that stat, and he's the only player not named Wilt Chamberlain to have 21-plus in both categories in a season. So it's him and Wilt.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. He's obviously a Hall of Famer and was a great player, but that's pretty good.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he's that. I was kind of surprised when I looked at it too. I was like, oh geez, like he's it. Like I kind of was like, either I at first I didn't know that he had that, and then I was like, oh well, then a bunch of people have had to probably have this, right? Oh, okay, no, it's just him and Wilt. So
yeah,
so Wilt has it a bunch. Wilt's got it a lot. So I guess maybe that clouds it. But
hey. That's fun though. Yeah, he was kind of a character in he had that he famously could memorize just about everything. He had the type of memory, that photographic memory, where he could read a phone book and then remember the phone numbers and things like that. And he would always like kind of do these memory games. He was famous for that. And he was a little bit of a guy who also was sort of thought of as a bit of a stat padder. Like he would, he would grab those rebounds. Any contested rebound would be, he would get instead of his teammate, that kind of thing. But then later it was a pretty, a good contributor for the Knicks toward the, for their second championship and last couple finals teams. So, ended up being a good player, but was just sort of a little bit of an odd character to deal with. And for a while had the reputation of being more of a stats guy than a winning guy, but, managed to eventually, as most good players do, managed to eventually win. So as far as the series goes, game one, since he actually was surprisingly won game one, Adrian Smith exploded for 26 points, who joined Oscar and Lucas both having 20 plus. Now, Adrian Smith, this was actually his only All-Star year. He spent most of his career with Cincinnati. But he was kind of the guy who Oscar mentioned as far as like, oh, we had great shooters in my day. Adrian Smith, for example, now Adrian Smith was not quite as good as Steph Curry, but he did. he was a pretty good shooter and, again, kind of had the, was kind of contributed a little bit to this team and, was a good secondary scorer and all that. They also had Happy Hairston, who was part of the Lakers 72 record-breaking championship team as well and, bounced around the NBA throughout these things. And they also had a very young John McLaughlin, who later was a key player in the great Bucks early 70s team. So they had some good contributors here and there, not really hugely celebrated guys, but, it had a good mix of guys. Although, again, this was kind of the last year for the Royals to be relevant as, the more talented guys left and, they weren't quite as strong. Anyway, game three, since he went up 2-1 on the backs of Lucas and Oscar with 27 each. And then game four, Boston blitzed the Royals 120-103, outscoring them in every quarter to tie the series. Sam Jones shook out of his funk to score 32 points. And the final game, Cincinnati jumped out to a 31-26 lead in the first quarter, but Boston put it away in the second, outscoring Cincy 35-25. Oscar had 37, but Lucas and Happy Hairston were the only Royals to be in double figures. Sam Jones had 34, Havlicek had 23, and then other players were in double figures, and Don Nelson had 9 points. So again, a balanced effort from the Celtics, and a little bit of a surprisingly tough battle for them, but they obviously managed to make it through, and I believe every series they had in 66 went the distance, because I think the conference or the division finals went the distance, and then the finals that year went the distance. So so a little bit of a rough year for the Celtics, but they managed
Figure it out. What's going on?
They managed to pull it out. Yeah. So of course this was the eighth and final win championship in that championship streak. But you know, the series this year for the Sixers only won 5 games, so it did not go quite the distance. But either way, they still they managed to win their eighth in a row. Red Auerbach managed to go out on top as a champion, and you know, still good times afterward. But the end of an aspect of that era, I guess you could say.
Absolutely.
All right. Anything else, Rich?
Nothing else. I mean, yeah. Again, we sort of talked about it at the beginning, but I think the big part of this, and we don't really, you don't nearly need us to tell you this, but I mean, maybe we do, is that Oscar Robertson was very good. And you should probably appreciate him a little bit more, because I feel like, you know, there is an appreciation, but a lot of it is, oh, he averaged a triple-double in the season. And it's like, yeah, that's cool. But like, he had a really, I mean, more than just that season, more than just that individual season. I mean, yeah, like we said, Curtis pointed out that in a 5-year span, he averaged a triple-double, which is just insane. But just like to see how, just what he's able to do on individual game levels too, I think that's something that always amazed me, is like going and looking at the logs, the game logs, and seeing the output that he would have in certain games, especially in big games. It's just incredible. And he's a guy that I've, in doing this, appreciated even a little bit more than I already did.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely a big game player. I mean, he was just such a, you know, a force as, as a lead guard, you know, was one of the first, you know, really big passing and scoring guards, kind of a guy who could do both and also be, you know, he was a pretty stout defender. And even though this team was not necessarily, probably he was a little bit weaker of the defensive end, but still, I mean, he was a guy who just had incredible size and incredible speed, and was not, he played a very kind of unflashy fundamental game, even though he had all the skills, and you know, he could still beat guys off the dribble and stuff like that. But he wasn't going around and dunking, and wasn't like necessarily the stylistic pioneer that you know, some of the other players were, like an Elgin Baylor was, with, you know, these incredibly fancy moves. I mean, Oscar was just more of a you know, just doing the basic stuff, and just, you know, would just, you know, get to a spot and kill you from a spot, and would do all, you know, all this kind of basic stuff, and just do it so incredibly well that he would, you know, was incredibly effective.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for checking us out. We have a couple more WrestleMania episodes to get before we move on to other things. But we're appreciate everyone giving us feedback on what we've been doing. We always appreciate that. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. We are also on iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to leave us a rating and review, we would greatly appreciate that. It's always nice to it helps other people find out about what we're doing, and we like more people listening to what we're doing, because it satisfies our egos, and we definitely have giant egos.
Oh,
so
come on,
yeah, exactly. So
More people interact with on Twitter. You know, more people find out about us. More people are interested in NBA history. More people to talk about it, because now, you know, get sick of the same 5 people. Yeah. We appreciate you guys. I'm just joking. I feel like when we started, it was mostly like 2 people. It's growing a lot. I think there's like a solid rotation of guys now that we have. That'll interact with us about NBA history, which is awesome. Like,
yeah,
because we're kind of just shouting to ourselves for a while. But
we're talking about. It's a niche.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge niche. I mean, a small niche is what I meant to say. It's growing. It's growing. Yeah. So I like it.
I'm happy with our audience, and happy. You know, it's so nice to have people who, you know, appreciate what we're doing, or, you know, are interested in engaging with us about NBA history. It's always fun. We like talking about it, obviously. So, keep doing that. And until next time, thanks for listening. We'll be back again soon.